Heavenly Father, we thank you for the Sabbath, and we know that on the Sabbath that you promise a double blessing if we would meet the agreements of the Sabbath. So we ask at this time that you would bless us, that you would pour your Holy Spirit out upon us in latter rain power as you open the message to our hearts and minds, that you'd grant us the presence in each of our experiences of the Holy Spirit and fill this room with your angels to prevent any distractions from taking our thoughts away from the subject at hand. I ask that you would hide me behind the cross, take control of the thoughts and words that I have, that they might be your thoughts and your words, and what's presented might be clear and would glorify and honor you. We thank you for all these things. In Jesus' name, amen. We're dealing with Daniel's last vision in order to identify the daily in the book of Daniel in such a way that we can ultimately get to the point where we're considering the subject of the Godhead and Adventism today and the controversy that surrounds it. When it comes to Daniel's last vision in chapter 10, verse 14, Gabriel comes to Daniel and tells him that he's going to let him understand, teach him what is going to befall God's people in the latter days. He identifies that this truth is represented in the Chalzon vision. And then he leads into the prophecy of Daniel 11 that begins in the time of the Medes and Persians and goes all the way until human probation closes. We looked in our last presentation about our responsibility to understand the events connected with the close of probation. And those events are the last six verses of Daniel 11. And when it comes to correctly identifying the last six verses of Daniel 11, there is an important quote that Sister White has where she identifies that in the prophecy of Daniel 11, there are histories that are repeated when the prophecy of Daniel 11 is ultimately fulfilled. Sister White in Great Controversy, page 356, says at the time of the end is 1798. So when Sister White is speaking about the future fulfillment of Daniel 11, as she's going to do in this quote we're going to read, she understands that that has to be verses 40 to 45 because verse 40 begins with the words and at the time of the end. Verse 40 begins in 1798. And Sister White was living after 1798, so when she says the future fulfillment of Daniel 11, she has to be speaking about the final movements of verse 40 onward. So in your notes, you see a long quote from Manuscript Releases number 13, page 394, which says, "We have no time to lose. Troublous times are before us. The world is stirred with the spirit of war. Soon the scenes of trouble spoken of in the prophecies will take place. The prophecy in the 11th of Daniel has nearly reached its complete fulfillment." As I said, she understood that the time of the end was 1798. So when she's talking about its complete fulfillment, she's talking about the last six verses. "Much of the history that's taken place in fulfillment of this prophecy will be repeated." What prophecy? She just referenced what's prophecy in the previous sentence. "Much of the history that's taken place in fulfillment of Daniel chapter 11 will be repeated." She's giving us an important principle here. She's saying when we're going to understand the final fulfillment of Daniel 11, then we need to understand that in the beginning of Daniel 11, there are histories represented that are repeated in the last six verses of Daniel 11. Once she says that, then she identifies very specifically one passage of Daniel 11 that will be repeated. She says, "Much of the history that's taken place in fulfillment of this prophecy will be repeated. In the 30th verse, a power is spoken of that shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. An arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries, But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. Yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame and by captivity and by spoil many days. And when they shall fall, they shall be holpen with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall, to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god and speak marvelous things against the God of gods and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that that is determined shall be done. Daniel 11:30-36. Scenes similar to those described in these words will take place. We see evidence that Satan is fast obtaining the control of human minds who have not the fear of God before them. Let all read and understand the prophecies of this book, for we are now entering upon the time of trouble spoken of. And then she quotes Daniel 12:1-4. So in the structure of her statement here, she first points out Daniel 11 and its final, its complete fulfillment. And then she gives us the principle that there's histories in the beginning of Daniel 11 that are repeated in the final fulfillment of Daniel 11. And then she's very specific. She quotes verses 30-36 and says, scenes similar to those described in verses 30-36 will take place in the last six verses of Daniel 11, is what she's saying. And once she closes her thoughts in that second paragraph, then to make sure we understand which verses are being addressed, she quotes Daniel 12:1-4. So she's specifically dealing with the last six verses of Daniel 11. And she's telling us that the principle to unlocking Daniel 11 is that there's histories in the beginning verses that are repeated. So we're going to look at the repetition of these histories, and we're starting to now move into the area where we will begin to deal with the daily. The daily in Daniel 11 and Daniel 12 is representing the political aspect of the daily, about the power of paganism being restrained, taken away in order for the papacy to be set up on the throne of the earth. Whereas the daily in Daniel chapter 8 is speaking about the religion of paganism that is lifted up and exalted by both pagan Rome and papal Rome and ultimately modern Rome. But we need to see the daily for what it is, then make the distinction between the daily in chapters 11 and 12 and then chapter 8 in order to get to the point where we can begin to apply some prophetic techniques to it. So Sister White says there are prophecies in Daniel 11 that are illustrated before verse 40 that are repeated in verses 40 to 45. We're going to look at three of those this evening. We've already discussed in our overview Daniel 11 verses 14 through 17. I'll remind you what that is if you're in Daniel 11, verse 14 through 17. In verse 14, the king of the north, Syria, as Uriah Smith would call it, the king of the north, is preparing to attack Egypt, the king of the south. And in this history, Egypt is very weak. Cleopatra and her brother are children. And in verse 14, it says, and in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south, against Egypt. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. Here, Rome, recognizing the weakness of Egypt, the pharaoh or the leader of Egypt, whatever he was called in that time of history, has died. His kingdom is left to his two children, and Egypt is very vulnerable, and pagan Rome's coming into history, so they take advantage of this history to identify themselves as the protectors of Egypt. They come into this history. Then in verse 15, Assyria, the king of the north, the power that controls Babylon, is is beginning this warfare. It says, so the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities and arms, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. This is the king of the north. This is Syria. And then in verse 16, we see pagan Rome beginning its movement to conquer the world. It says, but he that cometh against him, but pagan Rome that cometh against the king of the north, Syria, shall do according to his will. Pagan Rome is going to do what it wants. It's going to prevail. It's going to be stronger than Syria. And we know that historically the first place that Rome conquered as it began to conquer the world was Syria. Now there's a prophetic thing to mark here. The rule in Daniel 11 is that the power that controls Babylon is the king of the north, and the power that controls Egypt is the king of the south. So here in verse 16, when it says, but he, pagan Rome, that comes against Syria, the king of the north, shall do according to his will, and none shall stand before him. This is where pagan Rome conquers the king of the north, and therefore prophetically, in verse 16, this is where pagan Rome becomes the king of the north. Okay, whoever controls Syria is the king of the north. The first point of contact. Now, the first point of attack for pagan Rome as it's rising into power is Syria. When it conquers Syria in the prophetic rules of Daniel 11, it becomes the king of the north. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land by which his hand shall be consumed. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her. But she shall not stand by his side, neither before him. Of course, this is Cleopatra. And in this scenario here, you see him first conquering Syria, then the glorious land, which is Israel or Palestine. And then in verse 17, he's conquering Egypt. He's bringing Cleopatra under his influence, even though she's not truly sympathetic for him, with him. And if you go to Daniel 8, verse 9, you get a second testimony for these three powers. In Daniel 8, verse 9, speaking of the little horn, which in this place is masculine, it's speaking of pagan Rome, it says, and out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding towards the south. That's Egypt. And the east, Syria was east of Rome, that's Syria, and toward the pleasant land. That's what Daniel calls the glorious land, where we were just reading. That's Israel. Pagan Rome has to conquer three geographical areas, the first of which was Syria. And when it did so, it becomes the king of the north. And what I'm wanting you to see here, now if you jump forward to verse 40 of Daniel 11, okay, modern Rome, see, much of the history that's in Daniel 11 is to be repeated, okay, and the understanding of the last six verses of Daniel has been clearly established for the last at least 15 years. If you're unfamiliar with those, you can get a hold of the Time of the End magazine or the Final Rise and Fall of the King of the North or the many presentations now by the various voices in Adventism on the last six verses of Daniel 11. But in verse 40, the King of the North first attacks Egypt, the King of the South, so to speak. The power that controls Egypt is the King of the South. Then it overcomes the glorious land, and then it conquers Egypt. And in this threefold attack here in verses 40, 41, and 42, there is something very significant about how the king of the north conquers the king of the south. And in Thoughts on Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith, he comments on verses 14 through 17. That's what we're studying now, about how pagan Rome conquers Egypt. But before we read that, let's read from Manuscript Releases, Volume 21, page 444, so Sister White can tell us what her recommendation is about Uriah Smith's book. says the people in the world need to know that the signs of the times are fulfilling. To take them the books that will enlighten them, Daniel and Revelation, the Great Controversy, Patriarchs and Prophets, and the Desire of Ages should now go to the world. The grand instruction contained in Daniel and the Revelation should now go to the world. The grand instruction contained in Daniel and Revelation has been eagerly pursued by many in Australia. This book has been the means of bringing many precious souls to a knowledge of the truth. Everything that should be done to circulate thoughts on Daniel and the Revelation. I know of no other book that can take the place of this one. It is God's helping hand. Those who have been long in the truth are asleep. They need to be sanctified by the Holy Spirit. The third angel's message is to be proclaimed with a loud voice. Tremendous issues are before us. We have no time to lose. God forbid that we should allow minor matters to eclipse the light which should be given to the world. I kind of messed up the reading of that first paragraph, but here she's placing the endorsement on Uriah Smith's book, Thoughts on Daniel and Revelation. She says it's God's helping hand. And as I was saying in our song service beforehand, Frank Belden, who you see often in the hymnals, was her nephew. And many times he was at odds at the Lord's will while he was living in the same time period as Sister White. And one time he asked her a rather foolish question about thoughts on Daniel and Revelation, suggesting that Uriah Smith in this book was inspired. And I tried to dig it out of the CD-ROM. I couldn't pull it together. But her response was pretty much like this: I shall not answer that question. It was too ridiculous to answer, because she was on the record that even though the pioneers and these writers are to be studied and they're to be recommended and that we should read them, she did not say that their writings were inspired. But though she knew that Thoughts on Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith was not inspired, she calls it God's helping hand. And it pretty much is the best overview of the pioneer understanding of Daniel and Revelation that has ever been written. It is, from my understanding, the best. So if we go to page 262 of Thoughts on Daniel and Revelation, I want to show you something, and then we'll feed this thought back into verses 14 through 17 and see if we can see a history in those verses that's repeated in verses 40 to 45. Now, Uriah Smith's commenting on these very verses, and I'm just going to pull one thought out of it. He says, "The war growing more threatening, Caesar sent into all neighboring countries for help. A large fleet came from Asia Minor to his assistance." And this is the history of verses 14 through 17. Mithridates set out for Egypt with an army raised in Syria and Cilicia. Antipater, the Idumean, joined him with 3,000 Jews. Okay, they're coming. Pagan Rome is attacking Egypt, and they've already formed a league with the Jews. So not only do the Jews allow them to cross over the landmass of Israel, so they can go directly to Egypt, rather than come by boats, Israel lets them come across their country, but they also give them 3,000 soldiers. It says, Antipater the Idumean joined him with 3,000 Jews. The Jews who held the passes into Egypt permitted the army to pass on without interruption. Without this cooperation on their part, the whole plan must have failed. The arrival of this army decided the contest. A decisive battle was fought near the Nile, resulting in a complete victory for Caesar. Ptolemy, attempting to escape, was drowned in the river. Alexandria and all of Egypt then submitted to the victor. Rome now had entered into and absorbed the whole of the original kingdom of Alexander. By the upright ones, in verse 17, it says, upright ones with him. By the upright ones of the text are doubtless meant the Jews who gave him assistance already mentioned. Now notice what he says. Without this, he must have failed. With it, he completely subdued to Egypt his power, B.C. 47. So, what I want you to see here is, in this history, verses 14 through 17, Rome first becomes the king of the north when it conquers Egypt, or conquers Syria. Then it conquers the glorious land, or forms a league with the Jews, and it comes to the king of the south, what we've just read Uriah Smith's commentary on. But what Uriah Smith says is once it becomes the king of the north, when it conquers Syria, then it forms an alliance with Israel in 64 BC. When it comes to attack the king of the south, Uriah Smith notes that had it not formed an alliance with the glorious land, it could not have conquered Egypt. Did you read that? It says, without this, the last sentence, he must have failed. With it, he completely subdued Egypt to his power. So, pagan Rome conquers Syria first. It becomes the king of the north prophetically. It forms an alliance with the glorious land. Then it attacks the king of the south. The power that controls Egypt is the king of the south. And it wins. Okay, so the power that controls Egypt is the king of the south. So when pagan Rome conquers the king of the south, there is no more king of the south. The king of the south is swept away. The king of the north has conquered him, and Alexander's kingdom is reestablished. So the first movement for pagan Rome is to become the king of the north by conquering Syria, forms an alliance with the glorious land. Then it conquers the king of the south. Then it returns into the glorious land, into Israel, and it totally puts Israel into subjection. And then after that, there's a rebellion in Egypt. Now, Egypt is no longer the king of the south. It's been conquered here in this place. And the rebellion is the rebellion of Antony and Cleopatra. So Julius Caesar has to return to the battle with Egypt for a second time and deal with the rebellion of Antony and Cleopatra. And when he deals with the rebellion of Antony and Cleopatra, he's not dealing with the king of the south anymore. Pagan Rome's the one that is legally and politically controlling Egypt. There is no king of the south. All he's dealing with now is Egypt. Do you follow what I mean? Pagan Rome first becomes the king of the north when it conquers Syria, forms an alliance with the glorious land, an alliance that history and the Bible, when it says upright ones with him, and Uriah Smith says, without that alliance with the glorious land, it could not have defeated the king of the south. There was a political power controlling Egypt that had to be conquered, and when it was conquered, there's no more king of the south. All there is the king of the north. He's in control of the whole kingdom. Okay. Then he returns and he puts the glorious land in subjection. We haven't read that, but that's what he does next. And then after that, there's a rebellion of Antony and Cleopatra, and he has to deal with this rebellion. He has to return and deal with Egypt. He's not dealing with the king of the south this time around. The king of the south's already gone, prophetically. Now he's dealing with Egypt. So his three points of conquest after he becomes the king of the north. Once he conquers Syria, he's the king of the north. First, he conquers the king of the south, then the glorious land, and then Egypt. And modern Rome, in Daniel 11, first conquers the king of the south, then the glorious land, and then Egypt. But what I want you to see here is what Uriah Smith and the Bible and history is telling us, is that before pagan Rome, as the king of the north, can conquer the king of the south, there has to be an alliance with the glorious land. And of course, that's just exactly what happens in verse 40. Before the king of the north, the papacy, can sweep away the king of the south, the Soviet Union, in 1989, it forms an alliance with the United States. And all the historians identify this. And right here is one of your first arguments that the glorious land is the United States. So when it forms the alliance with Ronald Reagan and the Pope in the 1980s, then as pagan Rome, they come and they sweep away the king of the south. And the next point of conquest is the glorious land in the history of verses 14 to 17. And the next point of conquest for the modern King of the North is the glorious land, the United States. And the next point of conquest for both those King of the North, whether it's pagan Rome or modern Rome after the glorious land, is Egypt. So this is one of the histories in Daniel 11 that is repeated. Scenes similar to those in verses 30 to 36 will be repeated, but also, she says, much of the history that's taken place in fulfillment of this prophecy will be repeated, not simply verses 30 to 36. So this history of how pagan Rome conquers the world, it's a history that is definitely illustrated in verses 40 to 45. Now, there's a secondary history in the same verses, and we've referred to part of what I want to say here, is in this history, verses 14 through 17, as pagan Rome's taking control of the world, it has to conquer three geographical obstacles, okay? The first of which was Syria, the second, the glorious land, and the third, Egypt. And it conquered Egypt in 31 BC at the Battle of Actium. And if you're going to place a certain amount of confidence in the historical commentary of Uriah Smith, if you look up his comments on Daniel 11, verse 24, he will tell you that Daniel 11, verse 24, is speaking about pagan Rome. In verse 24, speaking of pagan Rome, of Daniel 11, it says, "He, pagan Rome, shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province. And he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and the spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time." The powers of history up to this time, if they were going to try to conquer the world, they went into a country and they conquered it. And pagan Rome did a certain amount of that. But there was a technique that pagan Rome used that no other power before it had used. He did what his fathers had not done, nor his fathers' fathers. And what was that? He conquered by alliance. He would make an alliance like with Israel, draw them into a relationship with them, share the booty of their warfare, and make them part of Rome without fighting with them. Okay, this is one of the characteristics of pagan Rome that made them different than the previous powers in history. And that's what Uriah Smith will tell you is being addressed here in verse 24. But the last phrase of verse 24, it says, "He, pagan Rome, shall forecast," and if you have a marginal reference, it says, "think his thoughts" for forecast. And sometimes you'll find this forecast as a broadcast. It's saying pagan Rome shall send out its decisions. It'll broadcast, forecast its thoughts, its devices, its thoughts. And this word "against," this is a very interesting word here. What is it? The seventh word from the end of verse 24, it says "against." In Uriah Smith's thoughts on Daniel and Revelation, he will show you that it's an acceptable translation for this Hebrew word to be translated "against," but it's also accepted to translate it as "from." And Uriah Smith argues that in this verse, it's really saying that pagan Rome would send out its decisions from its stronghold. And the stronghold of pagan Rome was the city of Rome. This verse is saying that pagan Rome would rule the world from the city of Rome. For instance, when Alexander the Great conquered the world, he conquered a country, he was there. Then he moved on to the next country, and he was there. He took his army. Everywhere he went, Alexander the Great went. And when he died, he was on the battlefield away from Greece. But not so with pagan Rome. They were going to make their decisions in the city of Rome. They were going to forecast their thoughts from their stronghold, and their stronghold is the city of Rome. And it's important to see that their stronghold is the city of Rome, because at the prophetic level, pagan Rome is the power that placed the papacy on the throne of the earth in 538. But at the end of the world, the United States is the power that places the papacy on the throne of the earth. Therefore, prophetically, pagan Rome typifies the United States. When you study the history, the characteristics, the prophetic characteristics of pagan Rome, you will see that it's illustrating the characteristics of the United States. And the United States has a stronghold. At the prophetic level, the stronghold for pagan Rome was the city of Rome. And when pagan Rome ruled the world from the city of Rome, it was invincible. The United States has a strength, a prophetic strength. It's called the Constitution. When you see the stronghold as the strength, when you see the city of Rome as the stronghold or the strength of pagan Rome, the lessons that are recorded in connection with the strength of pagan Rome is to be understood in relation to the strength of the Constitution. Okay, when pagan Rome was in the city of Rome, it was invincible, and it stayed in the city of Rome until the year 330. And in the year 330, Constantine moves the capital to Constantinople, and from this point on, the Roman Empire begins to disintegrate. And of course, at the Sunday Law, the Constitution is overturned, and Sister White tells us national apostasy is followed by national ruin. When the stronghold of the United States is thrown down, the kingdom's thrown down. When the stronghold of Rome was thrown down, the kingdom was thrown down. But this verse says that he would broadcast, forecast, think his thoughts from the stronghold, from the city of Rome, even for a time. And a time in Bible prophecy is 360 years. And pagan Rome, according to Daniel 8, 9, and 11, 14 through 17, it had to conquer three geographical obstacles. The east was Syria, the pleasant land was Israel, the south was Egypt, and Egypt was conquered completely, 31 BC, and a time later, and a time in Bible prophecy is 360 years. 360 years later, in the year 330, Constantine moved the capital. Pagan Rome ruled the world supremely for 360 years. This history is repeated in the last six verses of Daniel 11 because this is the third obstacle for pagan Rome, and there were two before it. For modern Rome, there are three obstacles: the king of the south, the glorious land, and Egypt. There is a second testimony to this in Daniel 7. In Daniel 7, verse 8, let's start in verse 7. After the leopard, after Greece, in verse 6. In verse 7 it says, "And after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast." The fourth beast, of course, is pagan Rome. "After this I saw in night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. And I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things." When the papacy takes control of the world, and when it begins to rule supremely, before it rules supremely, and its time to rule supremely was 538, and it was going to rule for a time, times, and half a time, which is 1260 years, which ended in 1798. Before the papacy could be placed upon the throne of the earth and rule supremely, three geographical areas had to be plucked up: the Ostrogoths, the Vandals, and the Heruli. And the third of those was the Goths that were driven out of the city of Rome in 538. So we see with pagan Rome, before it can rule supremely, and with papal Rome, before it can rule supremely, three geographical obstacles have to be conquered. And this history is in Daniel 11. It's in verses 14 through 17. And Sister White says, "Much of the history that's taken place in fulfillment of this prophecy, Daniel 11, will be repeated." And in Daniel 11:40, we have the first geographical obstacle for modern Rome, the Soviet Union, the King of the South. In verse 41, we have the second geographical obstacle for modern Rome, the glorious land, the United States. And in verse 42, we have the third geographical obstacle for modern Rome, Egypt, representing the entire world, the United Nations. This is two of the histories that are repeated in the last six verses of Daniel 11. Although these are closely related, verses 14 to 17, one way you look at the history is you see the flow of the movements of pagan Rome as it conquers the world, and you learn a lesson that before Rome conquers the king of the south, it has to first form an alliance with the glorious land. The second lesson is that these three obstacles of pagan Rome and papal Rome are teaching the student of prophecy that whatever the king of the south, the glorious land, and Egypt represent, they have to be geographical obstacles. And of course, the biggest argument against this message in Adventism is that the glorious land of verse 41 is the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and the Seventh-day Adventist Church is not a geographical area. It's a spiritual entity. It doesn't fit with the prophetic testimony. Perhaps, and this is where we're going, another history. That's two histories that are repeated in the last six verses of Daniel 11. But the one that we're really going to focus in on now, the one that begins to open the door to our studies, is verse 31. And let's read verse 30 to move in it. This is the third history that will be repeated. And the reason that this history is more germane to what we're studying is because in this history we're going to find the daily. And here's the controversy in Adventism. If you think the daily is one thing, or you think it's another, whatever you think it is, forces you to understand a history that's in agreement with your definition of the daily. So suddenly the daily is important to understand correctly. Verse 30, and we're going to give you Uriah Smith's understanding of verse 30. It says, "For the ships of Kittim," and Uriah Smith would tell you that this is the Vandals that launched their attack against the Roman Empire from the city of Cyprus, which in Daniel's time period was called Kittim. This is the second trumpet of Revelation 8. It's attacking the Roman Empire. It says, "For the ships of Kittim shall come against him," come against pagan Rome. "Therefore he shall be grieved." Pagan Rome is falling apart now. I mean, the ships of Kittim, right here in the year 330, when Constantine moved the capital of the empire from Rome to Constantinople, the Roman Empire has been divided into east and west. This is the first part of its disintegration. Once you move the capital to Constantinople, in that day and age, it's just physically impossible to control and dominate Western Rome. It's too far away. It's now the kingdom's no longer one whole kingdom. It's two kingdoms, Eastern Rome and Western Rome. But in the year 321, Constantine had passed the first Sunday law. And the principle connected with Sunday laws is national apostasy is followed by national ruin. So by the time you get to 330, the national ruin is beginning to happen to pagan Rome. And at this point, you notice, and this is worth noticing, most Adventists haven't noticed this. The pioneers believed correctly that the trumpets represent judgments that are brought against Rome. And the judgments, why are the judgments brought against Rome? What is it that brings the judgments against Rome? What brings them into history? What happens that allows the trumpets to blow marking judgment? The Sunday law. The trumpets are the judgments on the Roman Empire because they passed the Sunday law. And in this history, there are two Sunday laws that we'll look at. But the ships of Kittim are the second trumpet, and they are Genseric. And Uriah Smith marks that history as, and my Bible is, the edge of my Bible has now disappeared, but I think it's 468, but it might be 420 something. 428. All right. So when ships of kit, he knows from previous presentations. When you get to the ships of Kittim coming against them, you're in 428. This is when Genseric comes into history. This is the second trumpet. The first trumpets already began to blow. But the trumpets are in response to the Sunday law. There's a Sunday law here that is marked in history and in prophecy. And this is a Sunday law from pagan Rome. There's a Sunday law here in 538. When the papacy takes control of the world, they implement a Sunday law. And after the papacy implements their Sunday law, then you have the fifth and sixth trumpet that respond to the papacy in this history, all right? Of course, the seventh trumpet, the third woe, is going to deal with modern Rome and the final Sunday laws. But it's interesting to note that you have a Sunday law here that, among other things, is marking when the papacy is placed upon the throne of the earth. And you have a Sunday law here that's implemented by pagan Rome. And at the end of the world, we, as Adventists, we know that there's two Sunday laws. And where's the first Sunday law Bible prophecy arrive? At the end of the world. Where does the first Sunday law at the end of the world that prophecy speaks about arrive at? The glorious land. It's a Sunday law in the United States. And who prefigures the United States? Pagan Rome. Okay, the first one at the end of the world is the United States. But what's the other Sunday law that we as Adventists understand? The worldwide death decree Sunday law, right? That's this one. When the worldwide death decree comes once the papacy is what? Placed upon the throne of the earth. And here the papacy is placed upon the throne of the earth in this history. This is the second Sunday law that's marked in this ancient history, and it's prefiguring the two Sunday laws at the end of the world. The Sunday law in the United States, national apostasies followed by national ruin, the world Sunday law. And in this history, what initiates, what brings about the trumpets is this history here, the implementation of the Sunday laws. And by the time you get to verse 30 of Daniel 11, it says, for ships of Kittim, that's Genseric. I hope that date's right, but okay, it is. Thank you. On the testimony of two, a thing is established, but the edges of my pages in some places are getting really, really poor, and I'm in the process of trying to move these notes to another Bible. For that reason. For the ships of Kittim shall come against pagan Rome, come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. Here in this history as the world's falling apart, it's just another 110 years and the papacy is going to be placed upon the throne of the earth. Pagan Rome begins to have a dialogue with those that forsake the Holy Covenant. If you keep your fingers in Daniel 11 and go to 2 Thessalonians, this is the classic, you know, the number one illustration of the man of sin, the papacy, in the Bible. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, it says in verse 3, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come. And the day he's speaking about in the previous verses is the second coming of Christ. Let no man deceive you by any means, for the second coming of Christ shall not come except there come a falling away first. In this history here, this is the history in the year 330, this is the history of Pergamos. Smyrna's back in this history, Ephesus is here. When you get to the history of Constantine, you're in the history of Pergamos, and this is the history of compromise. And it's in this history where Constantine does the work of bringing the pagans into the Christian church. He begins to downplay Sabbath, lift up Sunday, and there's a falling away that takes place in the Christian church. And this falling away prepares an apostate Christian church for the papacy to take control of. It says, Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalted himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he, as God, setteth in the temple of God. He's in the Christian church. He's in the temple of God. Setting in the temple of God, shewing himself that he is God. Remember ye not that when I was yet with you, I told you these things? Why did Paul say that? Why did Paul say, remember when I was with you, I told you these things? What Paul's saying is, I already gave you the sermon on this. When I was with you, I taught you that pagan Rome's now controlling the world, and that there's going to be a compromise that comes into the Christian church that will precede and prepare the way for papal Rome. And papal Rome will then take control of the world. And Paul's saying here in verse 5, remember ye not that when I was with you, I told you these things, because he doesn't want to write it. He does not want to write down in a letter that in the future, pagan Rome is going to be overthrown by papal Rome, because that would be rebellion, sedition. And if the Romans found out that he was making a prediction that the Roman Empire was going to be overthrown, he would be killed, and any Christian that had that letter would be killed. So he's speaking between the lines. He's talking about the man of sin, the papacy. He says, now remember, I already gave you this sermon. And then in verse 6 he says, and this is why these words are so cryptic. He says, and now you know what withholdeth, that he might be revealed in his time. The one that's going to be revealed in his time is the man of sin that sits in the temple of God. But when Paul's writing, there's a power that's holding him back. He's withholding him. That's pagan Rome. Pagan Rome is preventing the papacy from being revealed, placed upon the throne of the earth, when his time comes. What's the time for the papacy to be placed upon the throne of the earth? 538. It says, Know ye what withholdeth, that he might be revealed in his time. Prophetically, he's revealed in his time in 538. For the mystery of iniquity, this is the papacy, doth already work. The principle of the papacy is already alive and well in the time period of Paul. And what's the time period of Paul? What's the time period of Paul? Where are we at in history? When was Paul Saul? Where did Saul change to Paul? On the road to Emmaus. And what had just taken place prior to that? The stoning of Stephen. And when was the stoning of Stephen? AD 34. So when Paul's giving his sermons, he gets converted on the road to Emmaus, then he goes into Arabia for how long? For 3 years to study before he begins his ministry. So you're in, you know, AD 40, 45 or so, in that time period. And Paul is saying the mystery of iniquity doth already work. The principle that the papacy bases its philosophy, its church upon, was already working and active in that time period. And then he says, only he who now letteth, and this word letteth is better written as restrained, only the power, pagan Rome, that is now preventing, that is restraining the papacy, he'll continue to restrain the papacy until he's taken out of the way. This verse here is what William Miller come across that allowed him to understand that the daily is paganism. The daily paganism, pagan Rome, was taken out of the way in 508, which allowed the papacy to be placed upon the throne of the earth in 538. Pagan Rome would continue to prevent the papacy from rising to power until it was taken out of the way, and paganism was subdued at the Battle of the Visigoths in 508. It was taken out of the way then, and then there was 30 years of setting up the papal system.
So in verse 7, that's 17.
In verse 7, that's 508. Paganism was taken away in 508. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work, only pagan Rome, who now restrains the papacy, will continue to restrain him until pagan Rome is taken out of the way. Pagan Rome is the daily, and the daily was taken away in 508. Any resistance to the rise of the papacy was gone after the Battle of the Visigoths in 508. Verse 8, and then shall that wicked be revealed. Who's that wicked? The Pope of Rome, the papacy. He's revealed now in 538 after 508. The power restraining the papacy is taken out of the way in 508. And then in 538, the wicked, the papacy, is revealed prophetically, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth. Is the Lord going to destroy the papacy with the spirit of his mouth? Okay, you got to pay attention to here. There's an awkward verse here. Some people don't follow the logic here. And because we're here, we might as well finish it off. And then shall that wicked be revealed. Then shall the papacy be revealed in 538, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all powers and signs and lying wonders. So what does that verse say? That Jesus comes after Satan does a marvelous work at the end of the world. Satan, after the Sunday law in the United States, the Bible and Spirit of Prophecy teaches us that immediately after the Sunday law in the United States, in verse 13 of Revelation 13, they call fire down out of heaven in the Great Controversy. Sister White says that Satan, after the Sunday law in the United States, Satan appears to personate Christ and tell the other countries of the world that they need to pass a Sunday law like the United States has done. And during that time period, Satan is working with his signs and powers and lying wonders. And verse 10, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perished, because they received not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. So here we see the marvelous, what Sister White calls the marvelous working of Satan. But in any case, in order for the papacy to be placed upon the throne of the earth, there had to be a falling away first. So if you go back to verse 30 of Daniel 11, it says pagan Rome was going to have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant, and those that forsook the Holy Covenant was the Christian church that fell away from the truth in the time period of Constantine and thus prepared the way for the rise of the papacy. They are those in prophecy that fell away. They are those that forsook the Holy Covenant. And in this history of verse 30, pagan Rome begins to have a dialogue with the papacy. And Sister White more than once says that the Pope of Rome is the representative of Satan upon the earth. So when pagan Rome begins to have a dialogue with the representative of Satan upon the earth, does any power on the earth have the ability to outthink Satan? No, once you get into a communication with Satan, he's going to prevail. And in verse 30, the subject has been pagan Rome, but verse 30 is telling us where pagan Rome ceases to be the subject here in this passage of prophecy any longer. As soon as they take up a dialogue, an intelligence with papal Rome, now the subject of the prophecy switches to papal Rome. They have prevailed. They have conquered intellectually, philosophically, pagan Rome, and they become the subject of the prophecy. So in verse 31, it says, an arm shall stand on his part. His part here is now papal Rome. And the arms that stand up for papal Rome in verse 31 is the European kings that are going to place the papacy upon the throne of the earth. But they're going to do certain things as they're doing this work of placing the papacy on the throne of the earth. It says, they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength. And what's the sanctuary of strength for pagan Rome? It's in verse 24. We've already discussed it. It's the city of Rome. Okay, and in this history, the warfare that's taking place from the trumpet powers, the first, second, third, fourth trumpet, what is the object? What's the object? What's one of the main objects of warfare for the United States today? Who is it that more than any other they would like to capture or kill? Okay, so there's the point of attack, right, in one sense, just to give an illustration. But in this warfare of the trumpets, the point of attack was the city of Rome. All these powers that are represented by the trumpets, these barbarians that come out of Northern Europe or Genseric from Northern Africa, they're all coming after the city of Rome, which is the sanctuary of Rome's strength. And it says, arms, these kings of Europe are going to stand up for the papacy, and they're going to pollute the sanctuary of strength, because during this history, the city of Rome is going to be ransacked and ransacked. It's going to be polluted. And that is the sanctuary of strength for the city, for Rome. And they, that's the arms, and shall they shall take away the daily. They are going to be the powers that remove the religion and the political authority of paganism. They're going to set it aside in order to prepare the way for the papacy. And they are going to place the abomination that maketh desolate. And the abomination that maketh desolate is the papacy. It was placed upon the throne of the earth in 538. So there's five, maybe five things in there that you can take note of. First, pagan Rome has intelligence with papal Rome. They stand up. Pagan Rome raises up its military on the side of papal Rome. Then they pollute the sanctuary of strength, the city of Rome. They remove the prevailing religion, and they place the papacy on the throne of the earth. And this history here is repeated in the last six verses of Daniel 11. Okay, in verse 40 of Daniel 11, it says, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. This is 1798. The king of the south in this history is atheistic France. The power in Daniel 11 that is the king of the south is the power that controls Egypt. And earlier in our overview of this last vision of Daniel, we went to Revelation 11, verse 8, where we're told that spiritual Egypt in this time period is marking the French Revolution and the Great Controversy. Sister White tells us this spiritual Egypt is atheistic France. In 1798, atheistic France, the King of the South, is going to begin a war against the papacy. This is a historical fact. But the atheism of France, the France being the one that dominates the philosophy of atheism in that history, as time progresses, there becomes a power that is the premier power that dominates atheism, and this is the Soviet Union. When the papacy returns to retaliate against the King of the South in our lifetime, in our history at the end of the world, it's no longer atheistic France. It's the Soviet Union who has taken the mantle of the King of the South as history has unfolded. And when the papacy, the King of the North, sweeps away the King of the South in 1989, it brings chariots and ships and horsemen with it, representing the military strength and the economic strength of the United States. So when you go into the history of verse 40 and you take the historical testimony concerning the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, a very good source of reference is the book that's written by his dad was a well-known, conductor. Leonard Bernstein was his father. His name is, and I'm forgetting his first name, but his last name is Bernstein. And he is famous in the United States because he worked with, and all these names that I used to teach this so often that these names were right on the front of my mind. I don't remember them now, but Bernstein and one other reporter, and I'm not remembering his name, they were the two that found out about Watergate, and they got a Pulitzer Prize for the work they did on Watergate, on blowing the whistle on Richard Nixon. Carl Bernstein and the other guy I'm not remembering, they're both still alive. They're both. The other guy just wrote a book about George Bush not too long ago. What? Nope. But in any case, Bernstein, he wrote a book about Pope John Paul II. And in his book, if you go to that history, it's called His Holiness, John Paul II, and the Hidden History of Our Time is the subtitle. He'll give you the overview of the collapse of the Soviet Union. It fits right in with this verse 40 and the understanding that we teach of it. And Carl Bernstein will tell you that when Ronald Reagan and the Pope of Rome formed their alliance to bring down the King of the South, the Soviet Union, that at that time, the head of the CIA was a man named Casey, think it might be John Casey, but I could be wrong about his first name. And Casey was taking trips to the Vatican, it seems like once a week, but it might have been once every 2 weeks, to keep the Pope of Rome informed with what Ronald Reagan was doing in his work on to bring down the Soviet Union, and finding out what the Pope of Rome was doing on his part to bring down the Soviet Union. So the way they accomplished this secret alliance was through the head of the CIA, who was a hardcore Catholic named Casey. And so the communication that was going on between the papacy and the United States, it was accomplished by the Central Intelligence Agency. And verse 30 says that pagan Rome, the United States, would have intelligence with the papacy, them that forsook the Holy Covenant. So at the end of verse 30, the thing that introduces the rise of the papacy in 538 is a secret intelligence that went on between pagan Rome and papal Rome that's prefiguring the intelligence that was taking place between Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II. And that intelligence between them was accomplished by the Central Intelligence Agency. You know, I don't know who named the CIA the CIA, but it's in agreement with verse 30. And it says that arms would stand up on their part, and that's exactly what Ronald Reagan did. He began a massive military buildup in Western Europe, and then he began to take the nuclear weapons that are in Western Europe and point them at the Soviet Union. And they can tell which way the missiles are directed from their aerial photographs. This was threatening to the Soviet Union, so they countered by bringing their army to the borders of Western Europe, and they began a massive buildup. And right now, one of the things that is really making Russia wealthy, the thing that's making Russia a player in the world today, is that they've built a massive pipeline from Siberia that brings down oil, or is it natural gas? Brings down fuel from Siberia. And that was being constructed during the Ronald Reagan years in the Soviet Union. And who was paying for it? The United States. Okay, the United States was giving them loans to build this pipeline. And Ronald Reagan, at the same time that he's building up the military, he cuts off the money for that pipeline. When that money's cut off, suddenly the Soviet Union's thrown into a financial crisis because it could be borrowing money based upon the promise that they were going to finish this pipeline across Siberia into Europe. They're suddenly thrown into a financial crisis. They're trying to do this massive military buildup. This is ships and horsemen. So in verse 31, when it says, arms shall stand up for its part, the United States military strength and economic strength stands up for the papacy in verse 31 and verse 40. And it says, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength. This is yet future, although Sister White tells us that every principle of the Constitution will be repudiated. Okay, the word she uses is repudiated, and if you look up that word, it means denied. It doesn't necessarily mean that every principle in the Constitution is going to be a law written to overturn it. It's going to be denied. You can destroy a good part of the Constitution just by ignoring it and moving forward. And that has already began to take place. But at the Sunday law, the sanctuary of strength for the United States is going to be polluted. Okay, that's another characteristic of verse 31. And it says, they shall take away the daily. The United States, in verse 11 of Revelation 13, it begins as a lamb. It begins as a Protestant nation. Its two horns in verse 11 of Revelation 13 represent republicanism and Protestantism. But it changes by the end of the history of the United States. It's speaking like a dragon. There's a change that goes on. And the United States changing from a Protestant nation to apostate Protestantism, it began in the history of the Millerites, when the Protestant churches of the United States rejected the first angel's message in 1842. The religious part of the United States had fallen. But Sister White tells us the fall was not complete, it's progressive. The complete fall of the United States is the Sunday law. But in the Ronald Reagan years, the political side of the United States fell. Okay, because the Bible teaches can two walk together unless they be, except they be agreed. And the Pope of Rome and Ronald Reagan began to walk together in that history because they were in agreement. And although the United States had already become apostate Protestantism in the sense that they rejected the first angel's message, in the Ronald Reagan years, they now have thrown away their political situation as well. And the verse says that these arms, which in verse 40 is the United States, that they're going to remove, they're going to take away the daily. And the daily they took away in verse 31 was their religion. They were pagans. That was pagan Rome. And they set aside their religion in order to place the papacy on the throne of the earth. And the United States sets aside the religion of Protestantism in order to place the papacy on the throne of the earth. And Sister White has a very nice quote where she says, "All those that become confused on the meaning of Antichrist will ultimately end up on the side of Antichrist." And I'm pretty sure that's word for word. "All those that become confused on the meaning of Antichrist will ultimately become confused, will ultimately end up on the side of Antichrist." And Ronald Reagan tells us the reason that he was willing to form an alliance with the Antichrist of Bible prophecy. And Ronald Reagan would tell you that he was a Protestant Christian. But why was it that Ronald Reagan wanted to form an alliance with the man of sin? Ronald Reagan says, because he believed that the Soviet Union was the Antichrist of Bible prophecy. As a Protestant, he had been confused about who the Antichrist was, and he ended up on the side of Antichrist, and he took away the religion, the daily, Protestantism, the arms that stand up, they remove their religion for the papacy in order to place the papacy on the throne of the earth, which happens in verse 42 of Daniel 11. The pollution of the sanctuary of the strength is verse 41 of Daniel 11. The arms standing up took place in verse 40 of Daniel 11. And this history here is repeated in the last six verses of Daniel 11, but you can't see it. You can't see it if you think the daily represents Christ's sanctuary ministry. If you think the daily represents Christ's sanctuary ministry, then when you get to verse 31, you see that you teach that the sanctuary of strength that's polluted is the sanctuary in heaven, okay? And that the daily that's taken away is Christ's sanctuary ministry. And it's just, it's even hard to explain this convoluted understanding. But in our next presentation, we'll take some time to demonstrate that, at least from the perspective of the spirit of prophecy, that the pioneer understanding that the daily was paganism was 100% accurate. So we've looked at three histories in Daniel 11 that are repeated in the last six verses of Daniel 11. And our purpose for this is to begin to look at the daily. And we will do that continue doing that in the following presentation. Shall we pray? Heavenly Father, we are amazed at how accurate your prophetic word is to history and how often just small little words or small little phrases pinpoint such important truths. We see the history of pagan and papal Rome illustrated in our day and age, and we're in awe at the power of your word. We know that your word has power to change, and we ask that as we eat the understanding of these truths, if we bring them into our experience, that we would also receive the power that comes with your word that might change our experience into experience that perfectly reflects your character. We do not simply want to be settled into the truth intellectually, but we want to be settled into the truth spiritually that we might receive the seal of God. And we ask that this study that we're doing here might contribute to that work in each of us. And we thank you for these things. In Jesus' name, amen.